Jane Kelly is the Emergency Planning Officer for the Isle of Man Government and leads the Civil Defence Team. We've probably all relied on her team's expertise during storm and weather events, and though we might not know it, we are all a lot safer because of the plans she and her team have created for the unlikely but possible emergency events we could all face. She joins me now in the studio. We've just had, in the week just past, some interesting events that you would have no doubt had to plan for. So, first thing, snow. A little bit of snow and a little bit of ice. We've got gritter vehicles that clear the roads. Why do we end up getting in the mess that we end up in?
We start planning, working with the Met Office. We actually started on New Year's Eve, and we had a meeting on the 2nd of January. And unfortunately, what was forecast then wasn't really what we got, and we had a late warning came through on Sunday. But can I just say that the DOI teams had been working on the roads for a few days before that as well, with the yellow warnings that were out. So they're not a massive, not a large team, as you know, in your previous role. And they work exceptionally hard to keep those roads going. So they'd been out gritting all around the main arterial routes where they can. And then unfortunately, the weather changed a bit on Sunday, which wasn't what we were expecting. The hard ice that came in as well was the main problem. And that caused us some issues on the arterial routes and also on around the estates and on public pathways and that. So we had some meetings. We looked at the schools. We had to really try and get the schools open if we could. But it isn't a quick decision. It's not an easy decision. And as you know, again, we don't have loads of people on the ground to try and sort it out. So the decisions are made, and we try and do the best we can. The main thing is we always try and keep people safe. That's our highest priority. But we have to keep the island going as well.
And of course, one of the problems, again, that I do know because I was there as minister, when you're trying to grip roads, when it's not quite frozen, and it's and you get this kind of slushy, rainy sort of stuff falling from the sky, it tends to wash the grit off the road relatively quickly, which then means when it does freeze, you get a big problem.
Yeah, there is an art to it. There's an optimum temperature. And the wind also affects it. If it's really dry but very windy, it just blows it off as well. But you're right, when it's slushy, and we also need vehicles to drive on it to activate it. So it's a bit of a, we need you to drive on it, but we also need you to keep safe. And when it's really icy, we just need the teams to be able to get on and do what they need to do.
And one of the worst things, of course, driving in snowy or icy conditions is being in queues of cars.
That can hamper it can hamper the emergency services responding. It can hamper the teams doing the work that they need to do as well. And we get two or three snow days a year, so we're not experienced like they are in Norway and Sweden and places like that. And so skills perhaps aren't as good as they could be. There was a lot of chat on social media about snow tyres, and that's an investment that people may want to make, but it's for two or three days of the year or the icy conditions we do get throughout, the winter. But it's some of it is down to skill as well, and just a little bit of, do we really need to go out and get in the way of things that we need to get done?
Yes, I do remember. You brought it up, so I'll use it. That we had the big snow. Maybe I wasn't minister at that time. I think I was minister in DEFA, that really tragic big snow. Mm. And then people were saying, well, we need more gritters, more snow ploughs, more this, more the other. The last time we'd had a big snow like that was probably 10, 15 years, maybe even more, prior to that event. Yeah. You buy all this equipment, it sits there and gradually rusts and becomes obsolete before you actually get a chance to use it.
It's a massive investment. They're not cheap machines, they're not cheap vehicles. Plus there's all the training that goes with it as well, that the drivers have to be competent with them. And, you know, in the big scheme of priorities for the DOI, I would imagine that having 20, 30 gritters sitting there isn't their priority. We see it in the UK. Scotland have a vast amount of gritters, but they have a massive area to cover. But even they're struggling with the recent weather, the storms and the snow over the last couple of days. So it's a balance, isn't it, of what do we need and where we allocate the funding for. And, you know, it has to be looked at, but we've got to be sensible with it as well. And that's all about emergency planning. Emergency planning is one of those things where we plan mainly for things we hope will never happen, but we have to spend money potentially on things which will never happen, have shelf lives on them, and just become obsolete. And it's money that people will see as being wasted. But we have to invest in some things to keep us, resilient.
And of course, you have situations like the other storm that came through this week was Storm Goretti?
Goretti.
We were very lucky in that we hardly felt it at all. Whereas friends and colleagues in Jersey and Guernsey were very badly hammered by it, as indeed was a lot of the southwest of and south of England.
Yeah, and the impact for us will be people trying to get off island. Mm. So Goretti, I had some Met meetings this week to check that it wasn't going to change and it wasn't going to hit us, and they were confident. The Met Office are great. They were confident we were going to be okay. But the impact for the island will be travel disruption on the UK, in the UK, not on Ireland. So people who are going to the airport today to get off Ireland may find their flights will be cancelled because of the UK airports, or once they get to a UK airport, there may be no trains going, or the motorways are full of snow. So the impact is a ripple effect, really. So we're OK on the island, but it's that ripple effect when people go off to the UK.
And of course, the other thing, despite our weather forecasters being pretty good at being able to predict when weather is going to be bad and how bad it's going to be and where it's going to hit, they're not infallible. They can get it wrong. And indeed, when you've got violent storms coming through, they have a habit of changing course.
They do. And Kirsty Wilding, who's the senior Met officer, spoke recently about the difficulties of forecasting on an island in the middle of the Irish Sea, because we get the weather from the west, but that tends to be wet. From the north brings in the colder air, but sometimes it does miss us. And so we put plans in place and we twiddle our thumbs and we wait, and then nothing happens or a very small effect. And we're very conscious as well as of misleading the public and crying wolf too many times, but actually it's that planning. We can only go of the information and the intelligence we have at the time, and historical data as well, of when we saw this weather pattern last time, how did it affect us? So we have to plan. We can't just leave it to the last minute. And sometimes our plans are there and nothing happens and we breathe a sigh of relief, it's quite thankfully that's happened. And other times we just have to reassess our plan all the way through what's happening, because plans are written for a reason, but they have to be flexible and change as things happen too.
And of course you end up, it's the classic thing in politics, isn't it? You're damned if you do and you're damned if you don't. On the one hand, the Manx public will say, well, they're putting these warnings out, but we've had these warnings before and nothing's happened. And then you don't put a warning out and they say, well, why did they not warn us about this? So,
yeah. And that's, emergency planning job is to try and warn and inform the public, keep people safe, plan for events. We can't plan for everything, but we can have flexible plans in place which we can adapt. But we are very cautious of bombarding the public with information. So the warnings that are put out by the Met Office, the yellow warnings go out across everywhere. the amber and red we will put out using the Everbridge system as well. So if people have signed up for Everbridge, they'll receive the amber and red warnings. Because we get so many yellow warnings, we're very conscious of bombarding the public, and then they're missing the really important information that we're trying to get out to them.
And tell us a bit more about how you would sign up to that.
So Everbridge is the mass notification system. We had the sirens historically, and they'd come to end of life. They were actually confusing for some people because they thought it was the retained firefighters being called out, because it was, although a different sound, it was the same system. We used to have to test them every 2 months as well, which was all the civil defence volunteers going out around the island and standing by a siren. And some of them were falling down and not falling off the wall, but they were stopping working. And the company who made them, excuse me, had stopped making them. So maintaining them was expensive and difficult. So we replaced it with a messaging system, which will tell you what to do, tell you what the problem is, and tell you what we need you to do, rather than just a noise. So we still want you to, we'll tell you what's happening, we'll tell you what the safety message is, but we use it throughout the year for weather warnings, and that gets people used to receiving the messages.
And of course, most people get most of their information now either from their phones, from various social media apps, hopefully one or two of them still listen to Manx Radio. I'm sure a lot of people do and value the service that the radio provides in telling people when these sorts of events are on the way.
And the good thing about Everbridge is that you can sign up to how you want to receive the information. So you can get an email, you can get a text message, you can go on the app, you can get a voice message. We tend to really only use the voice messages if it's something really, really big, because if you've signed up for everything, every phone, app, email will start pinging in your household. And if you've got a few people in the house, it gets a bit noisy. But you can sign up for how you want to receive it, and we can send that message out. And we can also get you to respond. So we can, if you've signed up for it in a certain way and given us your address, and we think your address is in an area of danger, we can direct a message to you and to say your house is at risk, or are you safe, so we can do that. So there's lots of things we can do with Everbridge, but it is an opt-in thing. It's not a you must sign up, it's useful. And we see, when we have a weather event, we see an increase in sign up because people are spreading the word, which is really good.
And how many people would you say proportionally are signed up to it?
We've got over 9,000 people on there now,
right,
which is really good when you think about it, because some of those will be children. We take the children out straight away on the population, but there could be four people in the room. If one person signed up for Everbridge, four people will get the message.
Yeah.
And then they can spread the word. So, we've got over 9,000 now, and that's it increases every time we have a weather event.
And again, in terms of accessing that, presumably if people visit the Civil Defence website, where they would find information there, would they?
So it's on the Civil Defence Facebook page. The link to sign up is on there, and it's on the gov.im emergency planning page as well, under Warn and Inform, and you just sign up.
Great, marvellous. So 2026 lies ahead, and we hope that we won't be getting any extreme weather events or any other reasons to use your services. How do you keep ready for events in the quite reasonably likely events that actually this year I know I shouldn't even be thinking about on these lines, but there's a fair chance that you can get through 2026 without any significant major emergency event.
Yeah, we do have a raft of plans in place. So the airport has a plan, harbours, there are pollution plans in place. We have plans for animal diseases in place. We have a raft of plans in place that are reviewed regularly. Emergency planning is a changing world. It's becoming more of a resilience profession, and we are in really encouraging everybody to embrace those, the way that we have changed emergency planning. We stand up different groups now. We tend to use the same terminology that the UK use. So when we're coordinating with them, we're all speaking the same language. So that's been a mass improvement. But we have plans in place. TT planning goes, you know, we've already started the TT planning in response to that for the emergency services and the government departments, as well as the TT organising their motorsport side of it. So we have various plans in place. And we have a major incident response plan which directs what we all do and who's responsible for what, which overarches everything. But everywhere who's got a risk will have a plan for that.
And it's not just you, because you work for the Home Affairs Department, or Home, is it Justice and Home Affairs? There's no
Department of Home Affairs.
Whatever they're called, yes, Home Affairs is what I like to call them. There are other departments, other agencies of government. So who else is involved in the emergency planning team?
So the emergency planning team for the Department of Home Affairs is a small team. There's two of us. And we're responsible for the civil defence. And we have regular emergency planning meetings at different levels. So the group that I chair, we have representation from DEFA, DOI, all the emergency services, public health. We have the Manx Utilities on there. We have some of the local fuel suppliers on there. And Coast Guard. We have, it's quite a Manx carer on there. Anybody who would be involved in incidents or has a risk that we need to know about. Then we have a tactical layer, which is chaired by one of the superintendents in the constabulary. And again, that's the next level of management up. So if my group identify any risks or any, you know, we need new equipment or we need more training, we push it up. And then above that is the strategic group, which is chaired by the chief officer from the Department of Home Affairs. And that has the chief constable on it, chief fire officer, department heads. And so there are three levels of management, and it might sound really heavy, but it's not. So the resilience group are the ones that are really on the ones on the ground, identifying any issues, raising it to the tactical group, who will back it and push it up to the strategic level. And that's our structure for emergency planning on the island.
I certainly remember when I was in Keys as minister in two or three different departments, there were occasionally meetings where we would all be called in to have these emergency planning meetings, and it felt so divorced from reality that it was quite a difficult thing to get your head around, I suppose, particularly as a politician, because you're always dealing in day-to-day detail of people's lives and real things, and trying to put yourself in the mind of what might be and what could be in terms of an emergency is quite a difficult thing. How do you get people who are, you know, it's not their day job really to deal with emergencies or even plan for emergency? How do you get them to take seriously these sorts of emergency planning events?
Yeah, it is tricky because finances are tight, as we know, and to try and get people to invest in things that may never happen is tricky at times. It can be difficult situations, difficult conversations, but we really just have to explain the risk to them. And, you know, the likelihood of it happening is important. The probability of it and the impact, that's massive. So if some things will be very low risk on the island, but if it did happen, it would be a massive impact. So we have to look at that, and everything's got to be judged, and those decisions have to be made about where we invest in it. And but that's why if we can get plans down, we've got a starting point, and we can explain to people, this if this happens, this is our current plan. But we need some investment to make sure the plan would work. But it's a tough call when finances are tight to ask people to buy things to sit on a shelf that may never be used. So we try and work collaboratively and see what can we do on island to get us through the first sort of couple of days when we can then ask for maybe mutual aid from the UK, whether that's the emergency services or the military or other people in the UK, scientific advice or something. So we can get through that initial impact, taking into account we might need to have a ferry to bring things in. So we have to build in a little bit of resilience there and then see what we can actually do realistically on the island. We probably can't do all the platinum service that used to happen years ago, but what do we need and at what point do we need to reach out and ask for some more support? And that's the important thing now, looking out sensibly.
Because, of course, we've touched on weather-related emergencies, but there's a whole load of other things that could go wrong. We have an airport. There's all kinds of things that could go wrong there. There is still the threat of terrorism in the world. We seem to be living in a much less stable world politically than perhaps we've been used to. And all of these things potentially could cause significant emergency situations in the Isle of Man.
Yeah. And we have a harbour. We have fuel that comes in. We have gas that comes in. We have utilities. And they're our lifeline, really. So it's important that we do have those plans in place to protect that critical national infrastructure that we've got, and that we can make sure that, you know, if things do go wrong, we can respond effectively and call in for assistance if we need to. But we've just got to be sensible about it. And so the risk assessments that we do are across everything that we can think of. You know, we really have to look at everything. Environmental impact of incidents as well. Mental well-being, you know, we saw that on the back of COVID, that a fallout of COVID was mental well-being. So we have to make sure we've considered all that too.
And you mentioned earlier that you have two members of staff, you and one other, I guess. But you also have a reliable team of volunteers that you can use in these situations. Tell us a bit more about those.
Yeah, so I'm really proud to head up Civil Defence. It's a massive asset to this island, and they're a great group of volunteers, and they come out. We were out clearing school pathways on Sunday. We were out clearing areas on Monday. We were out at 4:30 on Tuesday morning clearing paths for the schools. So a massive... really grateful for their volunteering skills, because they're all ages. We sort of range from about 18 up to people in their 70s, but who are as fit as anything on the hills, you know. So we don't just do snow clearing and that. We're the main or the biggest island hill search and rescue team that we've got. We open up rest centres. We'll do that. We'll process people. We are medically first aid trained, so we can go out and do triaging. We can carry people off hills, and we'll just literally turn a hand to anything that we're asked of. But we are an emergency service in our own right. We're a blue light service, so we will go out. We can deploy on our own. If people ring CD up and want some help, we can go out and self-deploy. So we've got 47 on the books at the moment. We recruited quite heavily last year. We took 14 on last year because we had some retirements. And it's been their first year. It's been a bit of a baptism of fire for them. They've had weather events. We've had hill searches for high-risk missing people. It's been a busy time. We support local events. We do the end-to-end, the Manx Mountain Marathon, the Parish Walk. All really great events that we provide support to, but also it's brilliant training for us as well. So, yeah, a great, great team of people.
So were I or anyone listening to this programme to decide that, yes, this sounds like the thing for me, I'd quite fancy doing this. First of all, how do they go about applying to become a member of the Civil Defence team?
Sometimes it's word of mouth. If we get some retirements and we we pushed a big recruitment last year because we were our numbers were dropping with retirements. But generally, we try and fill one out, one in if we can. We've got a little bit of a waiting list at the moment. But the main thing is just give us a shout. You know, either send us a message on Facebook. I don't monitor Facebook all the time, I must say. It's not my primary job. But we will pick up the messages and get back to you as soon as we can. Or drop us a line or call us in the office. We invite you to come down to have a look. It's a massive team. You have to like us and we have to like you. You know, we've got to fit in. And I think people just don't understand what we do. But when you come down and see the equipment we've got a warehouse full of equipment. And some of that is for our own response and some of that is to support the other emergency services. So, yeah, just drop us a line or pop. If we're down at Tramode, if the door's open, pop in and have a chat and we'll show you around.
And we're... said listener to be successful in becoming a member of your team, how does the training work? What's the kind of the first steps?
So we do sort of a small few weeks of induction where we make sure people have obviously equipped properly, health and safety briefs, not the hands-on exciting stuff, but then we'll slowly, once we've worked them with as a group, we'll feed them into teams and they'll go out then with the teams and then they'll be fully involved in all the training that we do. So we train every Wednesday night for 2 hours on a Wednesday and we train on the equipment, hill skills. They're all qualified for National Navigation Award Scheme at bronze with most qualified at silver level. That's the qualification we expect people to have so they can go up on the hills and navigate safely with a map and compass. No high tech up there. And then we obviously have drivers, but we're all expected to do everything. As you go through your volunteering years, and you could do a couple of years, you could do 30 years, you know, one of our commandants been with us since 1984. So he doesn't go in the hills anymore, but what he does is the control and the radios and the logging, and he preps the equipment. And so as you go through your civil defence career, you get a little bit older. You might not want to be on the hills like a mountain goat all the time, but we'll find something for you if you are still wanting to volunteer.
And that wealth of talent that you then have can be deployed. And is it just you and your full-time support that plans how this all works, or are the volunteers also engaged in that planning?
So the Assistant Emergency Planning Officer and I are both the full-time officers for civil defence, but the others are officers as well. We use the fire service rank structure. So they do wear a rank. It is a uniformed emergency service. And so we have team leaders and we have incident commanders. So some of our volunteers are incident commanders as well and can go out on the ground and coordinate and work with the emergency services. And obviously it's all risk assessed, our dynamic risk assessments, because what the volunteers aren't equipped in or trained for, there will be an emergency service there as well that can do it. So obviously the fire service are probably the most equipped and trained in things like that. So it's a collaborative working, identifying our risks and making sure that we have got our role is fit for our purpose and we're not over, you know, stretching ourselves in some ways.
And a lot of people who are, I suppose, who don't have to deal with these sorts of things on a daily basis, they hear the word risk assessment and they think of fairly dry exercises which are quite dull and boring and their eyes start to glaze over. But this is, particularly in your field, a really important thing to be doing.
Yeah, for any of the emergency services, it's one of the first things you will do is risk assess the situation. And for everybody who's done first aid training, one of the first things they do when you find a casualty is check the area is safe. And that's what we're doing. We're risk assessing the scenario. We will speak to the other incident commanders from the other services and everybody will identify different risk. Some people have different risks and different levels of risk. So it is really important that ultimately, before we commit any of our resources in, we can keep our people safe before they save somebody else. Otherwise, we have more casualties and we've made the situation worse.
So the you mentioned there about the fairly basic training. Is there specialist training that maybe you get certain members of the team that become experts on one thing or another?
Yes, so we have some 4x4 driving instructors. So our 4x4 drivers are, you know, we've got our in-house driving instructors. We've got two volunteers at the moment who are doing their education qualifications, and they will become first aid instructors in-house. And also one of ours is a Hill Skills instructor. We're very lucky that one of our deputy commandant, Dr. Andrew Foxon, is qualified on Hills, and he's a massive help to the Corps because he can train so much for us on the Hills, and he does it for us, you know, not part of a business or anything. He's one of ours, and he provides his skills to us. So we're really lucky. So yes, there are qualified. We have to be able to make sure our people are safe, and that's got to be done by training, really.
I've received fairly basic training as a Southern Hundred Marshal. I tend to be waving flags these days rather than getting involved in the incidents. But you can learn to do quite a lot of really quite significant life-saving things in a relatively short period of time, can't you? And things that perhaps wouldn't seem like the obvious when you arrive and suddenly you see someone lying on the ground with blood pouring out of them. And that's the great skill that your team has.
Yes, it is. And that's why we train. You know, there's skills we train for that you hope you never have to use. But by training, it's that muscle memory, isn't it? And it's so that when you turn up to something, and, you know, you don't have to be wearing a civil defence uniform if you're just walking down the street and something happens. If you've had that little bit of training, you sort of kick in with, I know what to do here. You know, and you can help people. So the training's important because it keeps the skills going, which is why we like doing the events. We helped somebody last year in the Manx Mountain Marathon, where we carried a runner off the hills. Now, that's never happened before, but that's what we're there for. So we're there to support the event, but it's great for us. We're actually providing that skill, and we're training all the time.
The other thing that perhaps means that you have more to do than maybe would have been the case 30, 40 years ago is we do appear to be moving to a position where we have an awful lot less in the house ready for emergency situations. Certainly in my father's generation, they were used to providing everything for themselves in all circumstances, emergency or not. So there was always a supply of everything you needed if things like electricity or water or whatever stopped flowing. We don't live in that sort of world anymore, do we?
No, we've chatted about this before, about, you know, grandma's biscuit tins. The biscuit tins always had things in fuses, you know, sewing kits, spare batteries, anything you looked for. There was no biscuits in those biscuit tins. It was just full of just strange things that they'd kept just in case. But I think that was coming on the back off the back of the war, where they were still prepared, and we have, I think, lost that. So we are just about to launch working with the local authorities, actually, and we really appreciate their support on this. Something we've called I'll Be Ready. It might sound a bit cheesy, but we're trying to get the Isle of Man ready. And it's just to build a little bit of resilience into the households, really, where people can, you know what to keep in their store cupboards, know what to keep in you know, I know it sounds a bit old fashioned, but a wind up battery or a torch with batteries in it. Sorry, wind up radio, and a torch with batteries in it, because people rely on a torch on their mobile phone. But if you've lost your power and you can't charge your phone, you've lost your phone because you've been using it as a torch. So things like that that we need to maybe consider. What should we have in our house for a basic first aid kit? Where's the stopcock? How do we change a fuse? Or if the lights go off, how do we look in a box and know which ones, what's tripped and things? So we're going out on the 12th of February to Andrea's, first of all, working with Andrea's commissioners. And we're doing, I'll be ready. We've got the emergency services there. We've got some of the government departments there. So public health will be there. And we want people to come along, drop in, have a chat with us. Police are going to be talking about crime prevention and also the Herbert Protocol, which is something that they've launched for dementia patients. And it's a great way of, if you've got people in your family who you're caring for, it's a way of registering them so we can keep them safe. Fire service will be there. They'll talk to you about anything to keep your property safe. I don't want to spoil it. It might be a surprise if I tell you everything's going to happen. But please, we want you to come along and we'll give you some top tips. And we want you to go away just that, even if you've picked up one thing about, well, actually, I do need to keep some water in my, bottled water in case the water goes off. We're not trying to teach people to suck eggs at all. But we just want to try and get a little bit more resilience into the homes. And ultimately, that may reduce the demand on the emergency services. And because some of the more rural areas will have to be a little bit more resilient before we get there. And if you can do that, you know, if you've got to wait 40 minutes or an hour for somebody to get to you, if you just know how to put a plaster on in that time or something, that'll be really useful.
So your message, as people are finally getting through the last of the Christmas biscuits and sweets, keep the tin and fill them up with useful things.
Yeah, put some, you know, go and invest in a proper torch. Go and invest in a wind-up radio. We took wind-up radios. Why? Well, because we will put messages out. If we had a power outage, we will be using the radio stations to put messages out. As long as you've got some power, but I hope you have.
I'm sure the boffins at Manx Radio will make sure that we've still got something. And of course, you know, earlier in the programme we were talking about all these alerts and messages, but of course a lot of that relies on the system that we use. Most people now use Wi-Fi, which requires electricity, and if there was an emergency which resulted in a lot of the power lines going down, the radio then is the best place to go to.
It is just really about looking after yourself in your own communities and in your own household. But so, for example, you know, over the last couple of days, CD teams have been out gritting paths and roads, and really it's like going out and just throw some grit down yourself. Even if everybody just threw a handful or a bucket full of grit out themselves, eventually that gets driven along the road or walked along the pathway, and the roads are clearer. So we're making it, you know, just by looking after that small area of your own property helps us and isn't such a demand on our resources or on the DOI, who are desperately trying to, you know, de-ice a whole island at times. That's what the salt bins are there for. I saw a comment on Facebook that somebody had said, I didn't realise the salt bins were there for public use.
Gosh.
They are, you know, what they're there for, is so you can help yourselves. So it's that kind of messaging we want to get out through these roadshows. But also we want to, we're very conscious that if we had a big event, this community on this island is amazing. We saw it during COVID where local communities set up teams to help their communities. And we know that if we had a big event, people would want to help. And so we're looking at that, and that's, you know, building that societal resilience and harnessing that spontaneous volunteer into, and we can work with us where we can give them a health and safety brief. I know it's all about health and safety, but it has to be. We'll have to speak to them, you know, make sure they're properly equipped. They've got decent clothing on. If we're asking them to help in a search, have they got the correct clothing on? And we also have to talk to them about social media policy as well, because if we are doing things for safety in the community, and especially if there's vulnerable people involved, we can't have it all over social media. So we do have to brief people on that. But we are, you know, if we do have major incidents where we need help, we will be reaching out for that help. And that's where we're working with the local authorities to work with them to open up their local church halls or village halls and things and help us run rest centres, because we can't do everything. Civil defence cannot do everything. We need that help.
So the sorts of things that local authorities could do, I imagine, would include getting lists of people who may be interested in helping out. If the, I'm thinking about my patch now, Arbury and Rushen, if there was an event in Colby that, well, we could even say the snow and ice event that happened earlier in the week, if people actually volunteered to come out, we could show them how best to spread the relatively small amount of salt that's in a salt box to have the biggest impact.
Yeah, and it, again, you don't need to put a big bucket full down in one area. It is spread fairly thinly, really. But it is that, and it's things like identifying a key holder. So if we ring somebody at 3 o'clock in the morning saying we need your village hall opening, that they know they can go down, open up, turn the lights on, put the kettle on, and we'll evacuate people into it. So that's the bit where we're working with the local authorities really closely to try and get them, you know, because ultimately it's their communities as well, and they know their people. So when we did the big snow and Kurt Michael was cut off, Kurt Michael Fire Service were fantastic because they knew their people in their community and they knew the vulnerable, and we were able to target those vulnerable people. And that's the important thing as well, working with local communities, because you'll know if somebody's suddenly on crutches that, you know, isn't normally vulnerable but are vulnerable today. And that's working with the emergency services when we say, who's the most vulnerable in this street that we need to get out first? And so it is, we've got to work together. We can't keep working separately. We've got to really work together.
And I suppose this is a message that perhaps all government departments would be keen to get out, that rather than spending 10 minutes sending an email out to say that there's some weeds growing on the pavement in front of your house, actually, maybe if you spent that 10 minutes pulling the weeds, you could get the job done without using the resource that could be being used to fill the potholes or whatever it might be.
It is. You know, I gritted my road, I think, 4 times last week. Now, I'm getting on a bit now, and I'm hoping in a few years' time some of the younger people in that road will come out and join in, you know. And that's the message we're trying to get across to the younger generations, that we do need your help. You know, we just can't do everything. I'm a member of the public as well. I'm a taxpayer as well. And I'm very conscious of, I did say to my boss the other week, I'm probably the tightest civil servant in the government, because I really, you know, we really do have to try and get the message out. But people have got to help us. They really do. And we're not expecting them to put a uniform on or do anything like that. But when things go, you know, a bit peak-tongue, that we just need a lift, really, a little bit of a hand out there, keeping people safe. Checking on your neighbours, that's such a simple thing to do. But it's one less person for us to worry about, really.
And I imagine civil defence has its fun moments as well. Is there any particular moments that over the years that you can think of that was...
We have fun all the time, you know. I mean, we did the Breast Cancer Now sleepover a couple of years ago at Peel Castle. It absolutely threw it down with rain, and I never imagined that we'd be up there dancing with a sort of 8 foot 42 running around. You know, we take part in the events, we get involved in the atmosphere at the events as well. We supported Search and Rescue Dogs Association did the Arch Allegan run a couple of years ago around there, and there was fairy lights up, and guys, you know, we just made it a fun event for them with for that event. And we do, I mean, the other night we were going back down on our backsides, but we were laughing about it, you know. You just can't, you know, it's that team ethos. That's the important thing, that camaraderie in that team. Things go wrong, but, you know, it's life, but we just have to laugh at it, as long as nobody's injured. But, you know, we do have fun.
And yes, one of the things that perhaps we're getting less and less good at is just working collaboratively, working as teams and getting on with each other and thinking about the public good.
And I think as well, that's where a lot of the youth organisations are really important. You know, we have some great youth organisations on this island, and just because some of them are related to the military doesn't mean you have to join the military. But what it does is, you know, it brings a load of kids together who have fun, you know, ultimately have fun. Yes, they do have some discipline, but their confidence is amazing. The brownies, the guides, all those youth organisations out there will build resilience in children and will make children more resilient, which then brings resilient adults. And that's really important. You know, all the sports teams, everything, that team work really makes you more resilient.
And to describe the civil defence team as the Manx Home Guard, would that be an unfortunate...
I think so. I mean, that's when I first found out about civil defence. Well, what do they do? I can assure you we don't have any weapons, you know. We're not out there. They are highly trained, skilled volunteers who can turn the hand at anything, really. Hopefully we won't become the Home Guard. But saying that, across the world, civil defence is a worldwide organisation. And in some of the countries, they are armed militia, the Home Guard. The civil defence. So it's not unheard of in other countries, but not on the Isle of Man.
Which is probably just as well, isn't it? Yes, Dad's Army comes to mind, which of course would be Dad and Mum's Army now with the civil defence. But presumably you do still have the same kind of jollity that occurs in that wonderful sitcom.
Although civil defence was different than the Home Guard. If you watched Called Midwife... Hmm. I can't remember his name now, but the chap from the corner shop, Buckle, he was in the Home Guard. And then in the Civil Defence. And then Civil Defence became more, as the years went on, we became more involved with the Cold War and with radioactive monitoring, working with the Royal Observer Corps. And one of our roles on the island was actually that monitoring and the decontamination of casualties. So the whole role has changed, you know. But we do have fun at civil defence, but we work hard as well.
Well, we're almost at the end of the programme. If anyone's been listening and thinks, oh, yes, this, I'll be prepared.
I'll be ready.
I'll be ready. That this is a catchy idea. What are the top picks that you would say they should have in this biscuit tin sitting on the top shelf?
Yeah, so, you know, a first aid kit that will get you through... we'll deal with a minor cut or something like that. First aid kits, decent first aid kit. Some things like bottled water. So if your water goes off, that can happen any day. Or, you know, although Manx Utilities are really good at maintaining the water, but it just needs a burst pipe. If your water goes off, at least if you've got water, you've got something to drink. You know, my mum and dad used to fill the kettle up every night, and it used to really annoy me because I couldn't understand why they did it. And then one day I said to them, why do you do that? They said, well, if we got up in the morning and the water's gone off, at least we can have a cup of tea. And do you know, when it was like, well, do you know, you're quite right there. That's quite sensible. Canned tinned foods, UHT milk, you know, if you can't get out in the snow, you've got some UHT milk in. I will say toilet roll, but you don't need millions of rolls of it. I don't want to see the shelves at Tesco's or other shops.
That's the risk, isn't it? That you get encourage people to be prepared, and we end up with a whole room in the house full of tins of beans and toilet rolls.
Just a couple of things, you know, just store cupboard essentials, just so that if the weather turns bad, or the electric goes off, or the the water goes off, that you've got a bit of resilience in your cupboard. But really, some of the things that the police and fire and that are doing about crime prevention is really important as well. You know, locking sheds, locking your doors, don't leave your cars and your keys in the car, that kind of stuff. Just what might be common sense to some people, but it is not. You know, other people may not have thought about it. So that's the kind of thing we'll be pushing at this show. I'll Be Ready. What we're not going to be there to do is answer any problems with departments or anything. We're not there to solve, you know, appointments or anything like that. We're just there to give you some good advice. But listen to your advice as well. You may have some top tips that we've not thought about.
Your service is a vital service for the people of the Isle of Man. Now, how would you summarise the service?
For civil defence, we are there to support the residents of the island, and you know, we turn a hand at anything, but we're there to support the residents of the island. And from the emergency planning side, we do really consider the decisions that we have to make when we have our emergency planning groups and stand up our groups. So we do know that we cause disruption sometimes with some of the decisions, but it is done with the best interest, and our priority is always to keep people safe. That's our number one target, is we will keep people safe on this island. So if we do have to close main arterial routes or the mountain road, it's done with the best intent to keep people safe, but also to keep those who are responding safe too.
That was Emergency Planning Officer for the Isle of Man Government, Jane Kelly. So what do you think? Have we become too reliant on government to solve all our problems? Could we do a bit more to help ourselves? Let me know your thoughts on the programme by contacting philgorn@manxradio.com and get in touch if you have any ideas for future shows. Don't forget, this programme is available as a podcast. I'm Phil Gorn. Go to Myos and Geisachrom. Thanks for listening.